In my talk this morning, I want to start out to address an issue that I think for policy is very important, and that is, you know, how have temperatures changed, particularly in the last 100 years, and is what we are seeing in observations consistent with the notion that humans are playing a significant role in changing climate, particularly in the last 50 years. So the slide I'm going to begin with here comes from the IPCC report, whose phone just rang. And it shows a series of maps, and I want you to look at each of these maps, and let's start with the one down here in the bottom. It's a global map, and you'll see that there are three things on each of the map. There's temperatures in the vertical axis, and time from 1906 to 2005 is in the horizontal axis, and there are two bands that you see in each of the graphs. There's a red band and a blue band. The red band is the range, the full range of a set of climate models from around the world in which the human influence on climate is included. That includes the emissions of greenhouse gases and other substances that we know affect climate. The blue band is the range from the models where they ignore the human influence on climate. Now, why do we have to rely on models to produce a graph like this? It's because we don't have a twin planet that you can, you know, if you're a laboratory scientist, you create a control without the reaction that might be going on in your main experiment. We can't do that. So we set the control, as it were, by running computer models with and without, in this case, the human influence. You will notice as you look at all of the diagrams that you see here that the blue band and red band begin to diverge in the latter part of the of the 1900s, and particularly from about 1970 onwards. That means in the model world, if I can call it that, that the human influence is coming out or should be coming out of the noise of the natural variability, which is the blue band. What is the black line on all of those diagrams? That's observations. So let's just go quickly through, and at the global level, you saw that they diverged, the two bands, and that the black line followed, in particular in the last 50 years, into the red band. It did not stay in the blue band. That means the real planet that we live on appears to be behaving like the model world with human influence and not the one without. And I can look at the global land average, which you see there, the global ocean average. Let's look at Australia. Australia is rather interesting. The climate models disagree quite substantially for Australia, and that's why the band is quite wide here. But you can see that the blue and the red band diverge for Australia in the last 20 years or so, and the observations are running right down the middle of the red band. And we can go to all other parts of the world. Let's go to North America. Similarly, some disagreement among the models. That's why the bands are wide. But the same story that I told about the global average and the land and the ocean average and for Australia holds. And we can go and look at each of these regions of the world, and we get the same story. Let me just go back. We get the same story. No matter which part of the world we look at, we see the observations are consistent with the notion that humans have an influence on climate. 10 years ago, I was a scientist that said I wasn't convinced that a good scientific case had been made to say that humans had a major influence on climate at that time. I'm convinced from evidence like this that, in fact, we have what we need to provide an impetus for policy. And that was one of the titles in my starting slide. With the notion that, humans are influencing climate, and as I say, I'm conservative on this issue but now convinced that that is so, that means you can't forecast climate in the future without forecasting economic development of each of the regions of the world. We're all in it together now. The human system and the natural system are joined together, and so you must model them together. So it's not a surprise we have developed at MIT a model which does that linkage, because it is an absolute necessity if you want to try to understand how the world's going to behave in the future and what we might do about it to lower any possible damages that we might be causing. Here is a cartoon that describes the various components of the integrated global system model that we've developed at MIT over the past 10 or 12 years. The first component up here at the top is a macroeconomics model that resolves all of the major countries of the world. I'll say a little bit more about it later on, obviously in a very short talk. I'm not going to be able to cover all of the technical details. More will be given later in the talk. Down here, we have a natural system model that links the components of the atmosphere, the ocean, and the land. And the ocean and on the land surface, it's very important to include the biology and not just the physical processes, because the carbon cycle, for example, is controlled substantially by biology. So that is included. It's important to consider urban emissions separate from emissions at large scales, because that's urban air pollution. So there's a separate modeling of urban air pollution within this model. Then there are linkages between the economics model and the natural system model. The most important is that big black thing you see hanging down from the red box there, and that's the emissions of climate-relevant and pollution-relevant trace substances by industrial and agricultural activities in countries around the world. And that is what's driving, principally what is driving the change that we see in the natural system, if we can indeed refer to it in that way. But then there are feedbacks from the natural system back into the economics, because we divide land ecosystems into managed systems, which are agricultural and forestry, and unmanaged systems. For the managed systems, there are economic impacts of climate change and air pollution on agricultural productivity, those feedback into the economics model. And there are many other feedbacks that are there, which I can go and discuss with you after the conference itself, perhaps over morning tea. And then there is a huge number of outputs from this that we use to try to assess the health of the world, both the social systems and the natural systems. There's things like GDP growth and a whole raft of other economic indices that are important. The blue text that you see there, you may not be able to read it in all details. All of the things we think of as physical climate, like temperatures and rainfall and sea level and so on. And the green text that you see in the arrow there are things to do with natural and managed ecosystems. Are they healthy? What are the key issues and indices that are important in those systems? Now, if we try to use this model to forecast climate, you can imagine all of those components. Some of you might be economics modelers. I know that there are a few like Graham that are very familiar with the uncertainties in natural system modeling. You have a problem, because you've got to admit from the beginning that the forecasts that we're going to talk about are going to be uncertain. But that doesn't give you the excuse to do nothing about it until scientists and economists have got it all worked out, because we never will be totally certain. That I can guarantee. We will never be totally certain. So we need to have a look at a very large number of forecasts, and that's going to be our basic approach. What are the big uncertainties in a climate model? There are hundreds, but the big three are the way you handle clouds in the climate model, how you handle the mixing processes in the ocean, and how you handle what are called aerosols. These are reflective and absorbing particles in the atmosphere. Good examples are sulfate aerosols from the burning of coal and black carbon from diesel engines that you're familiar with as you might travel around the streets. Fortunately, these uncertainties are constrained by observations. We don't have to take an infinite range for parameters in these models. But then you've got to add to that all of the uncertainties that go in the emission forecasting that, of course, link to the modeling of economic development and trade among the countries of the world going into the future. So this means the forecasts I'm going to show you are uncertain, so I won't show you a single forecast. What we do is we use a very large number of ensembles of runs of this modeling system with different assumptions in the economics model and in the natural system model that, if you like, have equal odds or equal probability. And the idea is at the end we want to show the odds of various outcomes or the probabilities of various outcomes rather than claiming great accuracy. So let's have a look at one of the results from the modeling system. And this shows latitude from from the Antarctic to the Arctic in latitude. And then it shows you the zonal mean temperature change between 1990 and the year 2100. And the three lines, the three red lines, show the 95% range. In other words, 95% of our forecast lay within that range at those latitudes. The upper curve is there's 1 chance in 40 of being at and above that. The middle curve, there's 1 chance in 2 of being above or below that. And the lower curve, 1 chance in 40 of being at or below that. So there's enormous uncertainty. But you look at that 1 chance in 40 upper line, and it's very dangerous territory. Dangerous territory because you see two things here. That first, there's enormous amount of warming, 12 degrees centigrade. I'll talk about in a few moments what the implications of such an amount of warming might be. But it's also clear, and all scientists agree, that the high latitudes are at the greatest risk. I think maybe Graham will talk about Australia and another issue, which is the interior of continents. But I will focus more here on the high latitudes and what's up there. Now, why is it that the temperatures predicted at high latitudes are much greater than the tropics? Two reasons. The tropics can export heat to the cold poles and do it all of the time. So there's a cooling mechanism for the tropics. They can send heat in the form of water vapor and sensible heat upwards and polewards. But also in the polar regions, there are unfortunately some feedbacks that occur that are bad news. As the poles warm up, ice disappears. Ice and snow disappears. In the summer, ice and snow in the polar regions in their local summer are reflecting sunlight to space. If that ice and snow disappears, you're replacing it with absorbing surfaces. You're accelerating the warming, in this case, the warming of the polar regions. Those feedbacks are included in all climate models that are used by the IPCC and for other purposes. The three red lines assume no policy is enacted. We just sit and watch for 100 years and forget about it. The three blue lines are the range you get when you have a policy or a set of policies globally that keep greenhouse gas levels at or below twice their pre-industrial levels. That's referred to as the 550 parts per million target that you often hear about, or the twice pre-industrial target. If the polar regions are warm much faster than the tropics, why should we care? We're not living there. For the most part, the populations are extremely slow. Well, first, let's talk about Arctic summer sea ice. Here it is in September 1979, and here it is in September 2003. And you can see, you don't have to be a mathematician or a statistician, a remarkable clearing of summer sea ice, particularly in the Siberian part of the Arctic Ocean. Very, very dramatic, steady, and this is not model world. This is the real world measured by satellites continuously. This is bad news. We're replacing a reflective summer sea ice surface with a strongly absorbing ocean, very dark ocean. That means that the warming is accelerating. Let's come back down into the southern hemisphere and ask about the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, a very small portion of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, but it's the one that flows out, and we see it in the big ice shelves that flow out in the Weddell and Ross Seas, into the Weddell and Ross Seas. Why would we care about these? As they warm up, the flows, the ice flows off the main sheet onto the shelves, at which point sea level rise occurs, accelerates with warming. The flows increase because it's lubricated with liquid water. But also, the ice shelves get undermined by the warm water, and when that happens, that's equivalent also to ice flowing off the main ice sheet, which is grounded on rock, and being buoyed by the ocean. Bad news. The grounding line is the yellow line there, and what happens with undermining with water is that yellow arrow moves to the left as you see it, and as I say, that's the equivalent of simply shifting ice off the rock and into the ocean. Why would we care about this tiny fraction of the West Antarctic ice sheet? It's equivalent to 5 meters of sea level rise. The Greenland ice sheet appears to be warming and melting at a significant rate at the present time. It's nowhere near the size of the Antarctic ice sheet, but there's 7 meters of sea level rise equivalent in Greenland. You add 7 and 5 together, that's 12 meters or about 38 feet of sea level rise. Now, that's just a sort of a statement of theory, as it were, but if you look at the last time the world was as warm as it is today, or similarly, it's called the Eemian, about 130,000 years ago, there's very good evidence that sea level was 4 to 6 meters higher than it is today at that time. Now, you can look at the map of Australia and decide, you know, what's going to go underwater, and realize that most countries of the world, huge fractions of the population, live certainly within 4 to 6 meters of sea level, and they're going to get inundated. So we don't want to go into this risky territory. Another thing that happens at these higher latitudes is stability of the Arctic tundra and permafrost. Of course, that's frozen ice, but as it melts, as the Arctic is warming up, you'd say, okay, I'm converting solid, ice to which we can build infrastructure on, oil drilling infrastructure and pipelines and so on. It melts and becomes mud. That in itself is not something that is cause for great concern. What is cause for great concern is that those mud puddles, if I can call them that, will begin to produce methane and carbon dioxide at a significant rate. These wetlands have been built up and the organic material in them over the Holocene, over the last 10, 15,000 years in particular. There's about 550 billion tons of carbon stored in the Arctic tundra. How much is that compared to current emissions? It's about equivalent to 80 years of current fossil fuel emissions that we're putting in the atmosphere. Another unfortunate feedback as the polar regions warm up is that they will begin to exude greenhouse gases at a growing and growing rate. So the best way to think about this is we're at great risk. I was privileged to be in the Arctic Ocean this summer, which set the record for the least summer sea ice that has ever been recorded. And it was in the Kapitan Klebnikov, which you might have seen also in the newspapers when this was recorded. And this is the ship. We were there for 12 days in the Arctic Ocean, and only two of those days were we smashing through ice. Big disappointment, because all of us, if you've ever been on an icebreaker smashing through ice, it's a great experience. The trouble is, most of the time, we were like the lower image here. There's the Kapitan Klebnikov sitting in open water, warm water, and highly absorbing water for sunlight. And you can see. And now, is there anything up there we should care about? Well, here it is, a photo taken from the Kapitan Klebnikov of a polar bear and mother and her two cubs. They swim between the icebergs that you see there, and they are feeding. They wait for the seals to pop up. Well, of course, if there's no ice, then their lifestyle is gone. They will have to live on the land and do something else. For sure, they're in trouble. And then here are the walruses at the bottom here. There's a lot of life up there that are just signals. It's not going to be the end of our world if they disappear or are decimated. But they're signals, like the canary in the coal mine, to say, do we really want this to happen? Do we really want to continue into these dangerous territories that you see here? Another area that's important to understand is that the ocean is exceedingly important in the climate machine. Why? It's doing two big things. It's soaking up about a quarter of the carbon dioxide that we put into the air is soaked up by the oceans. It can do that only if it is stirred from top to bottom, where the water at the top that gets saturated with carbon dioxide gets pulled away from the top and it goes down to the bottom of the ocean or the great depth and is replaced by water that is less saturated and can suck up more carbon dioxide. In the process of vertical stirring, the ocean is also taking up heat. Both of these things are slowing the rate of warming due to the greenhouse gases as they are accumulating. The ocean is a precious part of the climate machine. Now, is it possible this vertical stirring could slow down? So this is runs of the MIT model in which we allow carbon dioxide to increase for 100 years, and then for the following 900 years, we keep carbon dioxide constant. This is known as stabilization of greenhouse gas level. It's what everyone is talking about for policy, right? And each of these curves that you see here are differentiated by two numbers that you see running down the right-hand side. The first is the rate of CO2 increase that we assume. Now, that's under our control. It's under human control. The other number is called the climate sensitivity. I won't go into the technical issue there, but the range of numbers that you see there is roughly what we scientists think is the range. But nature controls this number. We do not. Nature controls that number. Now, you see that there's a set of curves. The black one assumes no greenhouse gas increases over the first 100 years. It's as though we stabilize them, for example, at today's levels. And the result is no change in this ocean circulation. The vertical axis is giving you the rate of overturn. All of the other curves, you'll notice, they drop down for the first 100 years while CO2 is rising, then for another 100 years when CO2 had stopped rising, and then about some of them recover over the next 900 years. That's good news. So there are two regimes. The ocean recovers in the top set of curves. The bad news is the ocean does not recover in the lower set of curves. The blue curve right in the middle between these two regimes was 1% of increase in CO2 a year, leading to about 750 parts per million of CO2, okay, at that the stabilization level. Now, is that the real trigger or threshold between these two regimes, the dangerous one and the recovering one? We don't know, because this is model world. But again, do we want to take the risk that the ocean circulation that we depend on so much will collapse, with the notion then that carbon dioxide will no longer be significantly soaked up by the ocean, and all sorts of other effects? Hurricanes are dependent on sea surface temperature, because that's the source of their fuel, which is water vapor. You call them cyclones here, of course, in this part of the world. This is work by Kerry Emanuel at MIT, and the vertical axis is what's called the power dissipation index, well known to the insurance industry. It's a measure of the damage done by a hurricane or a typhoon or a cyclone. And in the horizontal axis is just simply two curves. The black curve gives, based on measurements, gives the power dissipation index for the Atlantic and the Western Pacific over a time period from 1950 onwards, and you can see that this power dissipation index has gone up by a factor of about 2.5 over that time frame. The dashed black line is the average sea surface temperature between 30 south and 30 north. Now, you don't have to be a mathematician to say, looks like there's some correlation there. This is another worry. Are the hurricanes so sensitive to a relatively small amount of sea surface temperature rise in the tropical regions? This is a matter of research. This is not known for sure, but there are a lot of people working on this, and at least for the Atlantic, Manuel's work has stood the tests of other scientists. For the Pacific, because of lack of all of the observations we have in the Atlantic, it's still, I think, a little bit up in the air and a matter of research. I want to move now to talk about how we might manage the climate issue in my final slides. I mentioned that we have an economics model, a macroeconomics model, that models all of the major countries of the world and the trades between them. It has great detail in the non-energy and energy sectors, as you may expect, and of course in agriculture, which is a significant source of greenhouse gases. Here's an example of the challenge. Global primary energy. If we wanted to keep carbon dioxide at 550 parts per million or less over the next 100 years, how would we go about it? Well, this assumes that nuclear is restricted. Now, you can understand that in Australia, and maybe those of you come from other countries, many issues to do with nuclear. This is just an assumption. But here's how it looks. At the present time, as most of you know, about 87% of global energy comes from fossil fuels, and oil, gas, and coal are the big three. The top of the bars that you see going through time, through to the year 2100, that's the global energy demand if we have no change in efficiency. But then you'd say, in the year 2100, how can we meet this target? The first thing you'll notice is that this little gray piece up here. Those are gained with efficiency gains. In other words, the economics model is saying a very good low-cost option to address this issue is energy efficiency. Increase the efficiency, and that's about one-third of the solution that you can see here. What are the other ones? Coal with carbon capture and storage is another big one. It replaces conventional coal. Of course, it makes it more expensive, and I'll talk about the cost in a little while, but coal with carbon capture and storage, you can see, is a big player. Nuclear was deliberately restricted. Biofuels. That's simply, in this case, cellulosic processes. These are where you take grass and convert maybe 40% of the total mass of the grasses, which is the cellulose component, into things like sugars or alcohol and so on that you will convert into liquid fuels for transportation. So those are the big three, and of course you see that oil survives and gas survives and coal, conventional coal has died out pretty much, but replaced by the sequestration process. I want to say something about the U.S. because everyone thinks absolutely nothing is going on in the U.S. Well, there are now bills being considered in Congress. Will they be enacted? We will see. But here are some results from the MIT economics model analyzing the bills currently in Congress, which you can put in three categories. One which keeps the emissions in the United States constant at their 2008 levels, and a group that looks at a 50% reduction or an 80% reduction lower than 1990 levels by the year 2050. Those are very ambitious bills. And here are the CO2 equivalent prices. This is in dollars, US dollars, per ton of carbon dioxide, not per ton of carbon. There's about a factor of 3 2/3 difference between those. Here are the three curves, and no surprise, if you want 80% reduction, the carbon price rises to about $200 a ton of CO2. I'll come and say something very briefly about what that maybe means for the person in the street. And then you can see for the constant, it's only around about $70 per ton to keep them constant. So those are carbon prices, and those are what you need, right, to get what I showed you earlier to say, okay, what is moving us away from the conventional ways of producing energy and releasing huge amounts of greenhouse gases toward those more benign solutions with a lot less emissions, and here are the carbon prices. Another way you can look at the cost is to just simply look at welfare changes. Now, this is not the person on the street's definition of welfare. It's an economist's definition. For our purposes here, we can define it as the total consumption of goods and services in the United States in this case, because this is just looking at the U.S. And you can see the percentage reduction in that total expenditures that become possible. For the constant one, you'll see that the reduction is almost lost in the noise of the economic system. For the 50% reduction, it goes to about 1.5% lower in the year 2050, and for the 80% reduction, it's about 1.8% lower. Well, since total this consumption, as I defined it, or welfare, rises by 1 or 2% a year typically, then it's as though you get the consumption you would have had, but you get it a year later. Folks, this is something we can do. It is not going to hurt or destroy the economy. We can look after the planet, and we can have a vibrant economy, even in the United States. I'm sure the same is true for Australia. The final thing I just want to emphasize is the fact that if there's going to be a price on emissions, which I think is the solution, either with taxes or cap and trade or whatever, or a combination of those you do, it means that people will cheat. The only way you can check on people cheating is to measure the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and infer the emissions of countries around the world from that as an independent check on the numbers and books that will come out of governments and industries and so on, nice, well-written ledgers, but how do you know it's all correct? And my final push here is to say we need a lot more global monitoring stations of the type that I've got here, the Advanced Global Atmospheric Gases Experiment. Here are the stations in that experiment, and I want to emphasize that a big player in this experiment since 1978 has been Australia, CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology and their Cape Grim Tasmania station. Excellent site for monitoring Australian emissions, and it does so. We can sniff the air and find out what Australian industry is doing. It would be wonderful if Australia, as a rich country, decided to fill some of the major gaps north of Australia, first beginning to have stations right at the northern tip of the coast of Australia, northern coast, more stations that can sniff Indonesia, that can sniff air from India and so on. This is something Australia can do, and it'll give us confidence as we move towards a system of putting costs on emissions that the reports we are getting from various countries are correct. So that's a push for a continuation of the scientific measurements. These are tough measurements, by the way, and they engage some very, very talented people here in Australia and elsewhere around the world. Now my little fun thing at the end is to just talk about the odds and put it in terms that I think people can understand. Scientists talk about probability distribution functions. If I'm sitting in a plane and I give that term, people say, I wish I hadn't sat next to this guy. But if I show them the spinning wheels, they say, that's really interesting. Here is the probability of various amounts of warming based on the big ensemble of forecasts I showed you earlier if we have no policy. Okay, you can see the numbers there, and red is, of course, is the dangerous territory and so on. So about one quarter of the wheel is greater than 3 degrees centigrade global warming over the next 100 years. That means about 6 degrees centigrade polar warming. Folks, that does mean all of the unfortunate things I talked about, right, in the polar regions would happen. So that's dangerous territory by anyone's definition. Other scientists would say it might be 2 degrees, but I certainly believe 3 degrees centigrade is dangerous territory and 1/4 of this wheel, 1 chance in 4. Now, what would you buy with stabilization of CO2 at 550 parts per million? You buy a different wheel, and here is the other wheel, right? Now, this is a lot safer wheel to be spinning, because the greater than 3 degrees centigrade is a tiny little sliver. It's 1/8 the size of the one before. There's only 1 chance in 32 of landing on the 3 degrees centigrade. The idea here is you've just won $100,000 in a nice TV program, and you're about to walk out with your $100,000, and the MC says, just a minute, you have to spin one more time. And you look at the wheel on the left-hand side and you say, one chance, and if you get 3 degrees centigrade or greater, you lose your money. You say, oh, that's not fair. I thought I'd won all this money. And the MC then says, well, I have a proposition. Here's another wheel. How much of your $100,000 would you give to spin the wheel on the right instead of the wheel on the left? Now, when I poll people, they are normally quite willing to give up $10,000. Some of them, in a speech I gave a week ago, said $50,000 of the $100,000. That's because it was a prize, of course. The answer, truthfully, is it's about $1,000 or $2,000 that you ought to bid it for, because that's, you know, as I mentioned before, the lowering of the welfare in a particular year by that amount. That's what you ought to bid for. I think any sane person would give up a couple of thousand and spin the wheel on the right. Right now, we are spinning the wheel on the left. My proposition is it's time to move to the wheel on the right. Thank you.